you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us, and still on a high from yesterday's 22nd annual Film Week Academy Awards preview at the Orpheum Theater downtown. Have a packed orchestra level of the theater. Everybody on the words there of the critics just hanging on what they were saying and hearing their disputes over the films. So much fun. If you were there, thank you for attending, and what a great audience. And if you weren't able to attend, we hope you can join us next year as we take the films that are released this year into consideration. So many interesting and good movies. And we remind you that the broadcast of yesterday's program from the Orpheum will be aired on Film Week this week, Friday and Saturday, Friday at 10 o'clock and Saturday at noon here on LAist 89.3. Well, tomorrow is Election Day. At least that's historically what we've called it. Now that we have weeks-long voting periods, it's probably better to say the last day for you to cast or to turn in your ballot. The deadline is 8 o'clock tomorrow night, and we'll be providing live coverage here throughout the evening, starting with NPR's national coverage of Super Tuesday at 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. We'll have coverage from our fellow NPR member station, KQED, in the 7 o'clock hour along with NPR. And then I'll be joining you at 8 o'clock. Frank Stoltz will be with me. Jill Replogle covering Orange County politics. We have a bunch of great guests. That's tomorrow at 8 o'clock with our local coverage right after the polls close. But let's get you up to date on the races, beginning in Los Angeles County. And with us, the aforementioned Frank Stoltz, LA's civics and democracy correspondent. Also with us from Pomona College, assistant professor of politics, Sarah Sidwani. Frank, let's start with the LA County DA's race, which is the highest profile race by far in the county. And George Gascón is trying to hang on to his seat. He's facing a huge field.
11 people challenging the DA, and this is really a referendum on his policies. He came in 4 years ago and enacted a sweeping set of changes, including reducing criminal penalties, no longer prosecuting a whole range of misdemeanors, no longer filing gang injunction, allegations,
enhancements.
So he's all with an eye of reducing mass incarceration, reducing racial disparities into the justice system. And the question is, do people think he's gone too far with these reforms? And he's, as I said, facing 11 challengers, virtually all of them saying they're going to enact all or most of his reforms. So we see the primary folks, Nathan Hochman, the former candidate for state attorney general. He was the Republican nominee 2 years ago. We see a number of Gascón's own prosecutors running against him, John Hatami, John McKinney, Eric Sadal, the head of the Association of Deputy District Attorneys. And then we see a number of others who are former judges running against him. So it's going to be a really interesting race. The polls suggest that he will finish first, but not with a very high percentage. I think one poll put him at around 20%, which was extremely low for an incumbent.
That does not bode well for the November election, even if he's the top vote getter in tomorrow's election.
The question becomes, you know, who's going to come in second and challenge him in November. And if it's somebody to his right, that's kind of a old school lock him up prosecutor, that he'll have a chance of getting reelected
like
in November.
Like a Nathan Hochman, who ran as a Republican 2 years ago as no party preference now.
As opposed to somebody like Jeff Chemerinsky, who is somebody who's says that, yes, mass incarceration is a problem. I would embrace some of Gascón's reforms. And the question really is who will come in second? And, you know, the early indicators, Larry, are that it's going to be a very low voter turnout. So that could have a big impact on this
race. Yeah, and I'm curious how that factors into the race. Sarah, one of the things that's noticeable to me is how few ads Gascón is is running for this election, as though, you know, he's saving funds for November, maybe assuming he's a shoo-in to be one of the two this time around.
I think that's right. I mean, we haven't seen very many ads from him or from any of the other candidates for that matter. It's incredibly expensive, of course, to be running ads throughout the Los Angeles media market.
I have seen a fair number of Hockman ads.
Yes, yes. Hockman, I think, is perhaps the one exception. And I think you're right. I mean, most likely saving those funds for that runoff with the expectation that he's going to make it past this top two primary stage. I think the big question, as Frank laid out, is who is it that ultimately goes to that top to phase with him, assuming he can go, right? We don't know.
It's not a sure, with this big a field, it's not, I don't think it's a sure thing. You'd like his odds, but it's not guaranteed.
That's right. The California Elections and Policy poll actually had him at 15%.
Oh my.
But again, splitting the rest of that between 11 other candidates and undecideds, which are many. So, you know, a lot of my own research takes a look at then, you know, do things like surname end up coming into play? So, for example, one of the candidates, Maria Ramirez, is she able to perhaps garner some additional support from Latino voters who you know, in a crowded field with low information, might look to some of those other kinds of cues moving forward?
I think Gascon gets a bit of a bad rap because we've seen crime, at least property crimes, go up over the last few years. And he gets really blamed for that because of his policies. But we've seen similar trends in cities with conservative and liberal prosecutors across the state. As we know, there's a lot that goes into crime trends. And I think because this is a public safety year, I'll call it that, as opposed to a reform year when he was elected 2020, the year that George Floyd was murdered, and there was such upheaval that, you know, the question is, we go back to more of a traditional district attorney's race where who's going to be tougher on crime. But to blame him for the crime increase over the last couple of years, I think is a little unfair.
But
we'll hurt him.
But yeah, I think so. Especially in a low voter turnout. In November, he'll have the advantage, more than likely, of a higher turnout if he is there in November. But it's a fascinating race, and particularly, as you're saying, with so many candidates splitting the anti-Gascon, because this is, in a sense, a referendum on him, more than it's really about the other candidates.
Well, I think you might get in second place with as little as, what, 13-14% of the vote.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, this crowded field also reminds me somewhat of the sheriff's race that we had just 2 years ago, where, again, this was a referendum on Alex Villanueva at that point in time. Very crowded field. Robert Luna from Long Beach ends up in that top two, and all of those other candidates ultimately back him and really push that candidate forward. Will that happen here? It's to be determined.
And to pull the lens just back a bit, I think, you know, really it's a question of what direction justice wants to go in Los Angeles. In other words, are we going to continue on this path of reducing criminal penalties, of a system that focuses more on rehabilitation and on diverting people from the justice system, or are we going to move back a bit to the way things used to be done?
On the challenge for Gascon is he can't really point to rehabilitation at this point. That takes time, and so people don't really see that as the opposite side. But let's talk about the Board of Supervisors races, because Catherine Barger in District 5 is facing several challengers, including longtime state legislator Chris Holden, who is running to her left. Barger, a Republican, though certainly a moderate, no supporter of former President Trump. Barger's gotten a lot of support, including from Planned Parenthood, which is interesting because this is a case where she recognizes she's in a generally liberal county and a district that has arguably moved to the left even during the time that she's held this seat. Your thoughts, Professor Sodwani, on that race?
One of the key components in these supervisor races is that the fact that she's a Republican is not going to appear next to her name. These are nonpartisan races. So at the end of the day, what voters see on the ballot is that she is the current supervisor. they might, you know, infer that she is a woman. Maybe they like that. There's all of these other cues that perhaps happened for voters, especially if that's not the race that they have a lot of information about, which often tends to be the case. People will come out to vote in the presidential primary, which we know is not terribly exciting. We kind of have a sense of who those top two candidates will be. And so then moving down the list of all of the other candidates, there's not a whole lot of information that voters tend to have. Catherine Barger could absolutely come through this. Yes, she's a Republican, but she's been in that seat now for quite some time. Chris Holden, however, does have name recognition throughout the area. He's
parts of that district. Yeah,
through the Pasadena area for sure. He served on the city council. His father before him was a politician as well. So certainly that name recognition could help him out a great deal in this race, but it's still going to be a tough one.
Holly Mitchell facing challengers in the second, Janice Hahn in the fourth district. Hahn has one well-known challenger, and that is the aforementioned former sheriff Alex Villanueva. One would think still an uphill battle for him here after being defeated as sheriff. And the Hahn name, of course, Frank, I think it still has cachet in greater Los Angeles.
Oh, huge cachet. And the Villanueva name, you either love him or you hate him. He was thrown out of office a couple of years ago, and now he wants to be a county supervisor. And, of course, he rails against the system. He says that he would be the lone voice of reason on a board of supervisors that he, I think one time, called a corrupt cabal. Now he wants to join it. I think he and the third person in that race, John Cruikshank, who's a member of the Palos Verdes, Rancho Palos Verdes City Council, both running to the right of Hahn. But you're right, the Hahn name, her father was a member of the Board of Supervisors, her brother, of course, mayor, and she's been a Congress member and a council person from this very same area. So she has certainly the inside track.
And listeners might remember a couple weeks ago, we had Mayor Cruikshank on actually talking about the land movement separately from the race in Palos Verdes. He's an engineer as well as the mayor there. Let's talk about the L.A. City Council races where Nithya Raman, whose district goes across the Hollywood Hills from the Los Feliz area out into the San Fernando Valley. This is a very interesting race because it's really about, you know, her background, supported by the Democratic Socialists of Los Angeles. She ran very much as a candidate of the left. And now the question is she going to be able to hold this seat, which was redistricted, Sarah?
Yeah, her district looks very different today than it did 4 years ago when she first ran. She, of course, has much more of the Valley area in her district, which tends more conservative. And as we talked about even in the DA's race, this election is really a question of how far left has Los Angeles really gone and how far left do we want to stay? We know that in these primary elections, in general, that we tend to have older voters that participate in the election, slightly more conservative voters. Nithya Raman's probably going to come through this top two primary stage, but, you know, certainly the electorate has changed significantly, and it's a big question whether or not she can actually do that work to pull those folks in. We see a lot of momentum around Ethan Weaver, especially in those Valley areas. So it's likely that the two of them would advance to the top two primary and advance to the general.
And then do you anticipate we'll see a lot of outside money as this kind of referendum on progressive politics? And so outside dollars will come in behind whoever the two finalists are?
Absolutely. I mean, we're already beginning to see all of those independent expenditures being waged even at the primary stage. So absolutely, we're going to continue to see it. Nithya Raman, though, of course, has the endorsement of Mayor Bass, who's wildly popular throughout the city. She has a lot of star power. Her husband is also involved in the Hollywood industry, and she's had a lot of different celebrity endorsements. So all of those things are also going to work in her favor, but I agree, this is going to be the race to watch.
It's the race to watch, and I think what's really interesting about this race, and a lot of others, is how the issue has been in part around 4118, the anti-camping measure. And we have this report coming out, broken by our own Nick Gerda, last Friday, Friday that shows that 4118 isn't working. Well, Ethan Weaver, who's challenging Nithya Raman, has really hung his hat, saying that he would use that more to clear encampments. And we see this report that was delayed, that was actually produced back in November, but wasn't released until we got a hold of it at LAist, that shows that it hasn't been working, that it actually has just been moving people around. And Nithya Raman has been extremely critical of 4118. She's used it, I think, in very limited measures, if at all. And so what's interesting is we don't have this report until just a few days before the election, and it's going to play large coming in November.
We're almost out of time. We need to talk about District 7, Northeast Los Angeles, down through downtown. Kevin De Leon, the incumbent, of course, we know the scandal that he's been a part of for racist comments in that secretly recorded audio tape that was released. He's the last person standing politically from that and trying to hold on to his seat. In District 7, again, this got a very big field because he's seen as weak. Sarah, your thoughts about, is it possible that he can make it to November?
I think it's very possible he can make it to November. Despite all of the rhetoric that we've had across the city about the narrative of those tapes, we haven't spent a whole lot of time finding out what Latino voters thought about those tapes. And what we have seen throughout CD 14 is that there's continues to be a solid amount of support for Kevin De Leon. Let's not forget, he has represented some of these areas for nearly 20 years, serving as Senate pro tem. He was somewhat of a hero for many of these communities. That support doesn't completely go away, but it is a crowded field. Miguel Santiago, of course, is kind of the leading competitor with the support of the sort of machine politics of the Labor Federation behind him. But Isabel Jurado, the DSA-backed candidate, is also, you know, a real contender, I think. You know, you walk down York Boulevard in Highland Park, and there are Jurado signs
all
everywhere.
Yeah.
So I think it'll be a really interesting matchup on Tuesday to see who it is that actually emerges for November.
And DSA just is Democratic Socialist, just for that. And then John Lee in the Northwest San Fernando Valley also facing significant challenge there. So we got three LA City Council seats being highly contested. Sarah, you're going to join us next hour. We look forward to that, Professor. So thank you very much as we talk about what's happening in the world of national politics. And here in California, we'll talk about Proposition 1. And Frank, I'll see you tomorrow night.
Thank you, Larry. See you tomorrow night.
Coverage. Thank you. Sarah Sidwani's Assistant Professor of Politics at Pomona College. Frank Stoltz, LA's Civics and Democracy Correspondent. Tomorrow night, election coverage beginning at 5 from NPR Super Tuesday coverage here on LAist 89.3. Frank and Jill Replogle and I will be joining you at 8 o'clock with all the very latest on what's happening locally and in California. So stay tuned from 5 till at least 10 o'clock for full wall-to-wall election coverage tomorrow here on LAist 89.3. When we come back, we'll talk about an effort to get private colleges and universities in California to end legacy admissions. We'll be back in a minute.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today. Phil Ting represents the 19th Assembly District, which encompasses the western part of San Francisco and northwestern San Mateo County. He's introduced a bill, which has been introduced in the past, but was not enacted in California, which would ban state financial aid for students at private universities and colleges in the state that consider legacy as a part of admitting students. Legacy, of course, means that These are the children or grandchildren of alums of the institution. Also under that banner are those that are related to major donors of the institutions. Joining us to talk about the proposal is State Assembly Member Phil Ting. Thank you, sir, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Great to be on.
So how would this work if this were to be passed and signed into law and you had colleges or universities that wanted to still consider the legacy and donor-related admits? What would that mean for those students who would otherwise be Cal Grant eligible?
It would mean that students would not be able to use their Cal Grants at universities that continue to have preferential treatment for wealthy donors as well as alumni. And really what we're talking about is really only three major institutions in the state, which is Stanford, USC, and Santa Clara, who admit between 13 to 15% of their class and give preferential treatment to donors and alumni. And just to categorize it, that's 50% more than the number of African Americans they admit to their class and almost the same number of Latinos they admit to their class.
And are you saying the other private colleges and universities do not use legacy or donor connections as a part of the admissions process, or just the percentages are lower?
There's a few that do, but the percentages are far lower. We're talking 1, 2, or 3%.
And is there a threshold of percentage in your bill, or would this apply to any college and university who uses those filters at all in admissions?
There's currently not a threshold. Right now, it would be for any university that does continue that practice.
And what was the fate of the earlier version of this bill? At what point did it get hung up?
You know, got hung up in the first committee. We couldn't get it out of the Assembly Higher Education Committee, which is why we decided to turn it into a study bill and ask the institutions to report data, because we really didn't have any data. But what's great with that bill is now that we actually have data, we see what institutions really heavily rely on preferential treatment for wealthy donors and wealthy alumni.
We're talking with State Assembly Member Phil Ting of Northern California, the San Francisco Bay Area. Also with us is Professor of Clinical Education and Senior Scholar at USC Center for Enrollment Research Policy and Practice, Professor Jerry Lucido, who is not speaking on behalf of USC. He's just speaking on behalf of himself. Professor Lucido, thank you for being with us.
Good morning.
So what are your thoughts about using the Cal Grant as the way of trying to force these schools to stop using legacy and donor admissions?
Well, you know, the Cal Grant, Larry, and Assemblyman Ting, is a very powerful way that colleges and universities, the private ones as well as the public ones, in fact, advance their equity agenda by having more financial aid for students who need it. So the prospect of taking that away makes this bill a very powerful disincentive for colleges to do legacy admission. And I understand why that was chosen. There's a bit of an irony there, though, in that legacy admission, of course, is something that provides less spaces available to everyone. And using the Cal Grant to as a disincentive, is one that actually provides those spaces. But that said, I understand why the bill is constructed the way it is.
And I just wonder about unintended consequences, because I assume in many cases that the legacy and donor admits are paying the full rack rate of the education. So in a sense, subsidizing what other students who are getting assistance in paying for their tuition are getting. So is there an argument to be made, Professor, that this could actually end up making college more expensive, say, for middle-class students?
It's possible, Larry, if the colleges do not respond positively to the bill suggested. It could. In my experience, the people who do college admissions care a lot about equity, but as you noted, they have to balance many competing interests. They're our specific academic programs to fill, athletic rosters to compete, fine and performing arts programs, ensembles, orchestras to fill. And then, as you mentioned, there's the financial viability of the colleges to consider. All of these, you know, so who pays the bills and who's capable of paying tuition? All of these get considered in admission. And, you know, when you change one aspect of that ecology, other aspects are impacted. That said, I agree with the Assemblyman that legacy admission should end. I'm not certain that I would say that legislation or even citizens initiatives like Prop 209, which we know did a lot to harm the very things the Assemblyman is considering, you know, made it much more difficult.
We're talking with USC Professor Jerry Lucido and Assemblymember Phil Ting, who represents a portion of the San Francisco Bay Area. I'd love to hear from AirTalk listeners what you think about legacy admissions and what argument you would make for keeping legacy admissions or giving preference in the admissions process to family members of major donors of the institution, whether you think that there's a net benefit of that or whether you think that it harms the composition by privileging wealthier applicants to the institutions. The assumption being that for a legacy admit, it's someone who's had multi-generations of college education, so probably is comparatively better off financially. And of course, those who are family members of major donors, it's obvious there where they are socioeconomically. We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also email your thoughts at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Professor Lucido, I assume, you know, USC admits, as you know, a large number of international students. USC, I think, is one of the most hospitable campuses in the country to international students. I assume that, along with legacy and donor admit preferences, are all part of sort of the economic framework of the university. Is that true? Because, again, international students, they're paying the full price.
That's correct, Larry. International students pay the full price. I think there's a different set of arguments about international students and legacies. International students are part of a mix of students that you want to have at the institutions. It's, you know, on the other hand, legacy admissions are a number of practices, including programs like early decision or demonstration of interest, where a college gives an admission advantage to students who show they're interested. And of course, the more wealthy student can demonstrate that more clearly by visiting. And other practices that really advantage the more wealthy and the powerful. And yes, you're right to include international students here because they're expected to pay the full boat. I think that the issue here, and I think the issue that the assembly member is concerned about, is that these kinds of power that are exerted in college admission work to exclude individuals who don't even know that these practices are used because they don't have the right resources or counseling to help them compete for every open admission space. So I think this does need to be examined. And frankly, I would favor being very transparent about how all of these spaces are being used and who gets them.
And just one thing I wanted to mention, and you're probably aware of this, but for the early decision students, many schools, and I assume USC does this too, invite students from around the country that that are accomplished students of color or lower income to come visit the school at the school's expense. So that's one of the things that many institutions have done. My son actually did that as a student of color, visiting different schools and the schools hosted. 866-893-5722. Linda in Pasadena says, my son went to Stanford. They were clear, not everyone who gets in has ties to Stanford. How many legacies actually get rejected by these colleges? Well, certainly legacies do get rejected. They're not going to take students that are substandard, presumably. But the point Assemblymember Ting makes is that these three schools in California, Stanford, Santa Clara, and USC, it's a comparatively high percentage of the overall admissions to the school. Assemblymember Ting, you want to just elaborate on that?
Absolutely. I just wanted to also highlight a study that came out last year by Opportunity Insights. And what they found was looking at the Ivy and some of the most elite universities, including Stanford, that if you were a family making, if you were a family from the top 1% of the country, which is a family making over $600,000, you were twice as likely to get admitted to those same institutions as anybody else, the other 99%. And that is for children or for students who have the same grades, the same test scores, roughly the same activities. So even if somebody from a middle-class background was able to have the same grades and test scores, the people who can donate still have a twice the likelihood of getting into the same universities. And so that's really what we're trying to fight against, right? I'm not opposed to admitting a class of people who can pay. I'm just saying we shouldn't have preferential treatment for the wealthiest people in this country when they have all the advantages already.
Well, as part of that, though, that
it doesn't make any kind of policy.
Yeah, Assembly Member Ting, though, it is part of that, though, that the wealth is a proxy for other advantages. It's not necessarily directly the wealth, although in a donor's case certainly can be, but that this often are the types of schools, the types of tutoring. I'm sorry?
That's not what the study said. The study just looked at, again, you know, what you're talking about is, oh, the wealth buys you activities. The wealth gets you better test scores. This was, if the students had similar activities, similar GPAs, and similar test scores, the wealthy individual is still twice as likely to get in because of this preferential treatment.
David in Irvine, good to have you with us. David, your thoughts about legacy admissions and this bill.
Yeah, I am more concerned about the unintended consequences. I'm African American, and listen, I want more minority students in school. But there's a reality that these legacy students do pay full freight and do help fund monies for others. What about a cap instead of a ban? Because I know at African American institutions, there's not a lot in California, but they depend heavily on multi-generational people going to places like Jackson State and Howard and other schools. And I know this is just California, but the overall thought, I don't think I want to spread. Legacies are people who year after year after year contribute to an institution and help other students get in. I think we should think more of a cap than a ban. Those are my thoughts.
Thanks. David, I appreciate your call. Thanks very much. And I would assume that another factor with these institutions is that the more generations of a family that are associated with the school, the higher the giving, because there's a sense of an even deeper investment in the school. Kent in Palos Verdes Estates said this is government overreach, a classic example of the government picking winners and losers. Assembly Member Ting, you feel like the prospects for passing, given the study that's been done on it and how perhaps the political tide has turned a bit on this, do you anticipate the odds of passage are much higher now?
Yeah, I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful that this, you know, given that now we can't even take race into account, but we can definitely take someone's wealth into account. And also given this really groundbreaking study by Opportunity Insights demonstrating that, in fact, wealth really tilts the scales for these students, I think we have a much better chance of having it pass this year.
I want to thank you for being with us. That's the man who's written and introduced the bill, Phil Ting, member of the California State Assembly, representing a portion of the San Francisco Bay Area. And my thanks to Professor Jerry Lucido, professor of clinical education and senior scholar at USC Center for Enrollment, Research, Policy, and Practice. He was not speaking on behalf of USC. He was just speaking as an individual academic. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll be taking a look at the future of sports journalism as Sports Illustrated, the most revered journalism in the field of sports, has essentially fallen apart. ESPN has laid off a number of reporters. It's also known for its investigative and hard-hitting pieces on sports. What does the future of sports journalism hold, and why is it even important? We'll get to those issues when we come back here on Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.
It's election day tomorrow, of course, the California primary. We have more coverage of that coming up in our second hour this morning of Air Talk. And Super Tuesday across the United States, you'll hear live NPR coverage starting at 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. As the polls are closing throughout other parts of the country, you'll hear those returns in the primaries, some of the big state measures on the ballot, which give us a sense of national political trends. You'll get all of that coverage from NPR wall to wall. And then at 7 o'clock, we'll be joining with our fellow NPR member station, KQED San Francisco, for a look at some of the statewide races. And then at 8 o'clock, I'll be joined by Frank Stoltz and Jill Replogle. Jill will be covering Orange County politics in depth with the very latest returns, and we'll be talking about those important races and issues on the ballot in Orange County. Frank, of course, with his in-depth coverage of the L.A. County DA race, the Board of Supervisors race, L.A. City Council, and much more. And we'll be giving you the returns as the polls close in California. So please join us all in the afternoon and evening for continuous election coverage from NPR and from LAist here on 89.3. Well, sports journalism has taken a big hit, like all sectors of journalism lately. Sports Illustrated, which was really the gold standard. You know, for so many of us of my generation, we grew up eagerly anticipating our weekly copy of the magazine with beautiful photography, investigative journalism, analysis of sports, looking at so many of the issues of sports, not just a sort of, you know, mindless heroism of the athletes. It was a serious place to get journalism about sports, and it's now in disarray. And ESPN and other organizations cutting back as well. Ben Strauss is sports and media reporter for The Washington Post. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. You know, as a sports fan, certainly concerning to me, because I do think sports journalism matters. Share with me your thoughts, please, on why you think this is important, that we're seeing it diminished.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think you sort of touched on the sort of breadth of this, you know, just in the last, I don't know, couple of years. You're talking about Sports Illustrated is on the brink of complete implosion. The ESPN has had layoffs. The Athletic has had layoffs. The New York Times Sports Desk doesn't exist anymore. Real Sports, HBO's news magazine, it's not being renewed. The LA Times, of course, just recently lost a, you know, a big chunk of its sports staff. And so, you know, sort of the future of what this coverage looks like as sports becomes bigger and bigger business, is really a pretty open question that nobody has figured out. And I don't think it's, I think it's unfair sort of to think of it as the toy room, because I do think that, you know, between the public money in sports, between, you know, how big sports is in all our culture, you know, this is an important thing to have serious journalism about.
Yeah, I just think of so many big issues, from controversies over subsidizing stadiums to, you know, what's happened with racial issues within sports, the evolution of sports and what big money has meant to the game. There are just so many areas, plus in-depth look at the people that are part of the world of sports that aren't just candy coating, but really giving you depth about some of the challenges and fascinating aspects of the people who play at a very high level. How, you know, there are a number of economic factors that have just devastated journalism, but there's another issue in sports, and that is the whole regional sports networks and what's happening in the cable bundle landscape and cord cutting that's going on. Ben, how does that factor in to this, making sports journalism perhaps even more vulnerable?
Yeah, so I think one thing to sort of, you know, just back up is sort of the sort of devastation of the industry really cuts across all aspects of the media. You have, you know, troubles in local newspapers. You have trouble at digital outlets. You have trouble at, you know, place like ESPN, which for years, you know, counted on, you know, billions of dollars from the cable bundle. And so the journalism piece sort of, you know, cuts pretty wide, but also just in terms of how we're going to watch sports, which is similar, but a little bit separate, is also in question. So why is that important for journalism? Because you think about, you know, how are these players going to continue to make millions of dollars? How are, you know, these owners going to maintain valuations of their franchise? There's an awful lot of money tied up in sports. And when you come back to the cable bundle and regional sports networks, how these leagues are going to continue to make money the way they have for 30 years, and also how fans have going to be able to watch games as they have for the last 30 years, is certainly in flux, if not in, you know, sort of outright, you know, panic when you talk to some people at the leagues and in these, you know, in these teams.
And you wonder if it's just going to become well-to-do people who are going to be able to watch televised, you know, streaming sports. Because if you're not going to have the cable bundle subsidizing the high costs of sports, people who don't watch sports, you know, having to pay toward ESPN, for example, or TNT or whatever, then that means that the actual viewers of sports are going to absorb the full cost. And you're looking at pricey, I'm guessing, very pricey streaming plans to accommodate sports fans to be able to watch their local and national teams.
I think you hit it on the head exactly, that it's going to become more expensive to watch sports, to be a sports fan, no question.
Also joining us in conversation is B.J. Schechter, Executive Director of Seton Hall University in New Jersey's Center for Sports Media. He himself has a background in investigative reporting, worked for two decades at Sports Illustrated, the gold standard of sports journalism. Professor Schechter, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry, for having me, and good to be on with you as well, Ben.
So let's talk about the important role that Sports Illustrated has played, sort of setting the standard. Real Sports on HBO obviously broke a lot of stories, did important things. ESPN has too. Newspapers have broken a lot of important sports news. But what role did Sports Illustrated play in really carving out this field of serious sports journalism?
Well, I think SI from... You mentioned it earlier, Larry. When we were kids, I mean, we'd race to our mailbox every Thursday to see who was on the cover. That cover had, you know, a lot of weight. When I first was coming into the industry, you know, the best writers and journalists, not just in sports, anywhere, were at Sports Illustrated. So When I was lucky enough to get my dream job at SI at 23 years old, you know, I thought I was going to stay there for life. And it really was a murderer's row of talent. When you look at Alex Wolf and Gary Smith and Bill Metnack and Frank DeFord and Steve Rushen, I mean, the list went on and on and on and on. And we did journalism that mattered. I ran our investigative unit for years, and you know, we broke big important stories, and really, it, you know, SI helped as well as many other media organizations have a moral conscience on sports and on society, and as a cultural phenomenon that sports have become. Now we're losing some of that watchdog.
When we come back, I want to find out what you tell your students at Seton Hall who want to make a living in sports journalism once they're finished with their education. B.J. Schechter, Executive Director of Seton Hall's Center for Sports Media, Ben Strauss, sports and media reporter for The Washington Post. We're talking about the dramatic cuts in sports journalism, serious journalism, and what it means for the watchdog role of journalists on professional and collegiate sports, and much more. We'll be back in a minute. Thank you. just want to follow up on what Brianna was saying just a minute ago. That voter game plan has expanded in this election to cover Orange County as well. You've got a couple of Board of Supervisors races in Huntington Beach, some major and highly controversial ballot measures. You'll see all the coverage there. Plus, the Los Angeles County Superior Court judges detailed information about each of those races. So hard to get that information. The complete guide is available at laist.com/vote. With Election Day being tomorrow, this is a great chance for you, if you've not yet cast your ballot, to get the resources that you need to make an informed decision. That's laist.com/vote. And right now, we're talking about the future of sports journalism with B.J. Schechter of Seton Hall University's executive director of their Center for Sports Media, and Ben Strauss, sports and media reporter for The Washington Post. BJ, what do you tell your students there at Seton Hall who want to pursue sports journalism, given the uncertainty of the economics that underpin it?
Yeah, it's really interesting, Larry, because sports, as we know and we've been discussing, have never been bigger. There's never been more money in sports. But the media industry and the business models surrounding media are really in flux. And so what I tell students is, there's never been more opportunity to get into this industry and to break in sooner. When I was first coming up in this industry, and I'm sure Ben as well, you didn't have to understand the business if you were a journalist, if you were on the editorial side. You really do now. And so what's going to be that next platform? How are we going to be able to monetize content? I can't tell you where we're going to be in 5 or 10 years, but our students will be able to figure it out. And that's what we're trying to do with them and kind of building these innovation labs. And, you know, I think really what's important now, as we're seeing all this noise in media, is the big J question, and that's journalism, is to really instill that backbone, that foundation of journalism. And I think if we can do that with our students, together, we can help figure out that next platform, but I think the opportunities are there.
Michael in Santa Monica emailed us, an important role of sports journalism. Is there a coverage of the sports gambling problem? John in Fullerton emailed, it seems with sports, politics, and other news, the general population's looking for loud, opinionated voices, not less partial, in-depth analysis, a la Air Talk. John, thank you for that. I think of it as the transition of civil society to the professional wrestling model. People find it entertaining and reinforcing group membership at a time when there many are unmoored and lonely. Ben Strauss, I wanted to ask you about the role of social media here, because athletes go directly to their fans in a way they never used to. The journalists were really that filter, the access point for athletes. Now they have podcasts, they have social media, they're on Instagram all the time. So how has that affected the professional journalism of sports?
Pretty intently. We're superfluous. There was this construct in sports journalism. You know, you go back to the days of Babe Ruth, where it was like journalists come and they write about us, and that's how we get attention. That's how we build the brand. That's how we become more famous. That's how we get fans to talk about us. There was one way to communicate to fans, and this was true for, you know, almost 100 years, and very recently in the last, you know, 10 years or so, that is definitely not true. LeBron James can send a tweet out and reach more people with that tweet than I could with, you know, 100 articles. And so the utility of the sports journalist, and therefore sort of, you know, some of this watchdog that BJ mentioned, you know, role, that came with that, you've sort of lost power in this relationship with the leagues and the athletes. And that genie, I think, is pretty hard to put back in the bottle. One thing I would say about that is I do think, I think that there does come down to a supply and demand question. And in this moment, there doesn't seem to be from fans, from you know, observers, people who would pay for this kind of journalism, much of a distinction or, you know, willingness to pay for what, you know, you would call professional journalism. And I do think that at some level, a fan, you know, if your team isn't doing well, if your coach is getting fired, you know, there is you know, beyond some of this very serious stuff, a basic level of interest in covering these teams and finding out what is going on in that locker room. And much more so than a team website writer or, you know, an athlete on, you know, their own podcast necessarily, you would want a, you know, a hard-nosed independent journalist in there, you know, trying to get you that information.
Our senior producer, Matt D'Angelantoni, D'Angelantonio, like me, is a big sports fan, says he absolutely seconds John. Our emailing listeners says the fewer Skip Bayless's, Colin Cowards, Max Kellerman's, Stephen A. Smith's, and Shannon Sharp's we have, the better sports journalism has taken a turn toward hot takes that I think is not for the better. Real briefly, we have like 30 seconds for your response, BJ, but has that crowded out more analytical sports reporting, or can they coexist peacefully?
I think they can coexist peacefully. And I think it's really about context, right? You know, you can have access, you can have shouting, but really where journalists can come in and make that difference is to provide that context. And we need to get back to that sort of reporting and interest. And I think that's our big challenge in the next 5 to 10 years.
I want to thank you, gentlemen, for joining us and talking about the future of sports journalism. So many of us that are fans really, really want to make sure that that in-depth, serious coverage can continue, even as we don't know what the economic model for it will be. Ben Strauss is sports and media reporter for The Washington Post. BJ Schechter, for 20 years, investigative reporting at Sports Illustrated, now executive director of Seton Hall University's Center for Sports Media. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Election Day is tomorrow. Reminder, NPR live coverage of Super Tuesday starts at 5 o'clock right here on LAist 89.3, and it's wall-to-wall continuous election coverage through the night. I'll be coming on the air at 8 o'clock, joined by Frank Stoltz and Jill Replogle. We'll have all the local and state returns.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. And if you were with us yesterday for our 22nd annual Film Week Academy Awards preview, thank you for coming. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. What a great event. All 11 of our Film Week critics were on stage. We talked about a variety of the categories, including Best Feature Documentary. And coming up later this hour, we'll talk with the director of one of those five nominees, a terrific and very important film, To Kill a Tiger. We'll be talking with the director of that film coming up shortly. But right now, we continue with politics because, of course, tomorrow is Election Day here in California, and it's Super Tuesday across the United States. We're going to be talking about the national and statewide landscape with Marisa Lagos, political correspondent for our fellow NPR member station KQED, with whom we will be joining up with them in the 7 o'clock hour tomorrow night for election coverage. Marisa, so good to have you with us again. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Larry.
And back with us from last hour, Pomona College Assistant Professor of Politics, Sarah Sidwani. Professor, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Marisa, let's talk first about the U.S. Senate race here in California, where we've got three high-profile Democrats who are going at it in that race, and former Dodger Steve Garvey, the most prominently mentioned Republican in the field. This one already, a ton of money has been spent. You can't miss Adam Schiff. He's seemingly on every hour of television.
Yeah, and Porter as well. And thanks to Adam Schiff, Garvey additionally, because Schiff has actually been running a bunch of ads kind of propping Garvey up. They may come across to Democrats as attack ads, but I think what he's been trying to do is really raise Garvey's name identification in the hopes of ending up, you know, in our top two system in a runoff against him. That would clearly be an easier race in a state where only about a quarter, you know, of voters are registered Republican. And so this is really, I think, become a three-way race between Adam Schiff, Katie Porter, and Steve Garvey. Schiff looks pretty strong to claim one of those top spots, and I think it's really a race for number two at this point.
Sarah, I'm curious your thoughts about how the war in Gaza might play into this, if you think it does at all. For some voters in California, that is a huge issue, if not the most important. Adam Schiff, Congress member, has been very front and center in Israel's corner. He has not called for a ceasefire, has decried the Hamas attack against Israeli citizens. And I think, you know, in case of Barbara Lee, the member of Congress from Oakland, she's been calling for a ceasefire with Israel to stop its military action in Gaza pretty much from the very beginning. Katie Porter has been kind of between the two for a while. So how has that factored in voters' perceptions of the candidates?
It has to factor to some extent. Look, I think there's two different pieces going on here. One is money, right? Adam Schiff has a whole lot of it and he's using it. And he's not necessarily talking about that issue in his ads per se. So he's not queuing that up to be on voters' minds when they're selecting their Senate candidate. But this is absolutely a part of the voter base of California Democrats. You know, some months ago at the Democratic Convention in Sacramento, the pro-Palestinian protesters, the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party, shut down the convention. They had had solid support for Barbara Lee at that convention, but notably, no candidate left the convention with the endorsement of the California Democratic Party. And yet, what we have seen, nonetheless, is that despite all the jockeying of these sort of political elites, voters on the ground are ultimately pushing towards Adam Schiff. So I think it signals in many ways that perhaps this issue isn't as, even though, you know, LA, downtown Los Angeles, streets were shut down yet again this weekend with protesters. Certainly people feel very passionately about it, but that feeling isn't necessarily held widespread among the voters.
Yeah, and of course, it's who actually casts ballots. That's right. In the election. It's not even the overall voter eligible population of, that's right, of California that has the impact here. Marisa Lagos, I wonder also about the lift that for both Katie Porter and Barbara Lee, you know, outside of their districts, and I know Barbara Lee's been in Congress for a very long time, Katie Porter, a relative newcomer, but Adam Schiff, because of his prosecution of the first Trump impeachment trial, because of his prominence on cable news networks, he much better known in the state, making it, you know, for Lee and Porter, a tougher task for them to get known.
I think that's right. And, you know, to the point of the Gaza question, I think that that was an opportunity that, you know, Barbara Lee really missed being this anti-war candidate. She just struggled to raise the money to get out there. But Schiff, to your point, has gotten a lot of earned media over the years. He's a very sort of familiar face to Democrats, really centrist and progressives, I think, who watch, you know, cable news and things like that. And while polls do show that he is really stronger with whiter voters, older voters, that Porter does a little better with younger, more progressive voters, I do think he's done a pretty good job of locking up some support from kind of across the Democratic spectrum. And that has really posed a challenge. I mean, it is interesting. Porter is a pretty prolific fundraiser in her own right. You know, her past races for the House have been very competitive, and she's really done well in those in terms of fundraising. But it is a different animal when you're talking statewide. And I think that, you know, Schiff really has benefited from that familiarity and from the fact that he's gotten a lot of establishment support, including folks like, you know, Nancy Pelosi and others who have been out there, you know, talking about this endorsement, connecting with voters themselves.
Sarah, let's talk about Katie Porter's seat that she gave up to run for the Senate, because she ended up with it redistricting last time around, still won the seat. This is the 47th congressional district, and this one that, you know, Democrats, obviously, it's important they hold for the Democratic Party.
We're going to see a ton of money being spent in this election come November. We're already seeing that money being spent, particularly amongst the Democrats who are duking it out to make it to that top slot. It is a far more competitive district today than it was 4 years ago because of redistricting. It took in a lot of the beach city areas, including the city of Irvine. Dave Min, the state senator there, had early on gotten the endorsement of Katie Porter, which most people thought was a shoo-in. But then, you know, of course, he had his own personal failings with a DUI. And his Democratic challenger, Joanna Weiss, has absolutely looked to seize on that, has been running ads throughout the area, showing video footage of his sobriety test, reminding voters of that shortcoming. You know, but to Min's advantage, I suppose he's talked a lot about making mistakes and making amends for it and trying to make a comeback. I think the key component here to me is that there's a large Asian American population centered in Irvine. Many of those Asian Americans didn't necessarily go out and vote, weren't necessarily very engaged in the past. Yeah. Could Dave Min actually go and mobilize voters that haven't necessarily been, you know, strong Katie Porter endorsers in the past? It's a possibility.
And that's a heavily educated sector of the population,
absolutely.
Irvine as well.
Absolutely.
So certainly it's prime for voting. Let's talk about Adam Schiff's seat, which is centered on Burbank and surrounding communities. Marisa, let's talk about what the battle looks like there.
Again, a lot of Democrat on Democrat attacks. I mean, this is a much safer Democratic seat, and we have a number of pretty high profile, folks running for it, including Anthony Portantino, state senator, Laura Friedman, state assemblywoman, former city attorney, and assemblyman Mike Fuhrer. So definitely a lot of money being spent there to kind of try to differentiate these Democrats. If you are, you know, in that area of LA, I assume you've been getting a lot of mail and a lot of attention from these folks.
I've seen the mail going out to that district, and it's absolutely unbelievable the amount of money that's been spent. Marisa, let's talk about Proposition 1, because Governor Newsom essentially clearing the decks for just that one proposition to be on this March ballot. And this a huge bond measure, but it's not just a bond measure that makes it somewhat controversial and makes its passage iffy. Because, Marisa, this also takes money that's raised through the so-called millionaire's tax that counties control and award for mental health projects and move it under state control. And, you know, share with us kind of what the stakeholder battle is over Prop 1.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. This passed, I think it got a unanimous vote in the state Senate. And Larry, you know how rare that is to see anything pass unanimously. So there is a lot of sort of bipartisan support across the political spectrum, I think, for what Newsom is pushing, which is really the most concerted effort we have seen in decades, maybe over half a century, to deal with this population. But you have had pushback from counties who are worried that the money that they've spent, you know, in the past on things like preventing early screening for mental health, you know, getting people help before they spiral into addiction or homelessness, that money will be going away and will, you know, that'll cause them to sort of not be able to do that early intervention. And then you also have a pushback from folks on the civil liberties side who are worried because this does include language allowing for locked beds for people in mental health crises. You know, I talked to the governor last week in Sacramento, and he said that is part of his plan, but that's not, you know, the whole point. There's a lot of other beds and housing that'll be built. But we did see a poll come out Friday that, they had a lot of polls early showing support in the high 50s, low 60s. This is showing closer, you know, to the 50% mark, which is what they need to pass. I think that's in part a reflection of what we're seeing so far in terms of who this electorate might be. Ballots coming in are very slow compared to a lot of past elections, and they're kind of overrepresenting more conservative voters, more Republican voters, older voters. And so that is not, you know, I think the constituency that might overwhelmingly support this. I got a memo from the governor's campaign this weekend, and they seem pretty confident they can get this across the finish line, but they do know that it may not sort of put up those big numbers in a win that they had hoped for maybe 6 months ago.
And I think there also is some skepticism of the state of California's ability to execute programs between EDD and ongoing problems that the state has had in so many different areas, actually allocating funds and carrying out its responsibilities. I wonder how much of that might be some skepticism that's involved in response to Proposition 1. Sarah, your thoughts about Prop 1 and how close it appears to be at this point.
Yeah, I completely agree with Marisa that you know, 6 months ago, this was seen as a slam dunk. That, you know, of course, homelessness and mental health issues continue to be some of the top issues on voters' minds, not only here in Los Angeles, but across the state. And we have seen that support begin to waver on this proposition as more information has come out. We've also seen opposition to the proposition become more vocal over the course of these many months. So I think it will be a real interesting piece to see how exactly this lands with these voters who, again, I think she's absolutely right. Much of this comes down to turnout and who it is that actually is going to participate, who has already participated and who plans to show up tomorrow.
Well, it looks like it's going to be pretty low voter turnout, which we remind that means your vote's actually more powerful if you do turn out.
That's right.
So that's the flip side of that. Marisa, share with us what's on San Francisco's ballot, because it seems like every election there's fascinating stuff happening there in the city.
Yeah, well, we have a big affordable housing bond here as well. So I think that'll be interesting to see kind of where voters are, to your point about trusting government to spend more money on some of this. But then there's a couple measures that the mayor put on around policing and drug screening of welfare recipients that have become pretty controversial. The policing one, she says, is to help officers kind of unshackle them to do their jobs better. And it includes a provision that would really loosen restrictions on police chases. This comes actually as we're having some debate over this. The Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, just did a big research project showing that police chases often, you know, result in injuries. And so that one, I think, is one of the more controversial ones. And then, you know, we're gearing up for a mayor's race later in the fall. So I think how the mayor's ballot measures turn out here might give us a little bit of clue into her own sort of political strength or weaknesses, and just what she'll be running on this fall, because she's got a handful of challengers already.
Wow. Marisa, as always, thank you so much. We appreciate you talking with us and sharing your expertise on all these important statewide races. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Looking forward to working with you all tomorrow night.
Sounds great. Our 7 o'clock hour will be a joint broadcast with our fellow NPR member station, KQED San Francisco. That's political correspondent Marisa Lagos. And my thanks to Professor of Pomona College, Sarah Sidwani. Sarah, thank you so much for coming and being a part of both hours today. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm sure we'll be talking with you again very soon about the results of the election. So thank you. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we're going to be talking about one of the Oscar-nominated documentaries, To Kill a Tiger, an absolutely gripping story about a family that goes to great lengths to fight for justice for their daughter, who was sexually assaulted. We'll talk with the director, Nisha Pahuja, coming up with us in just 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. Coming up a little bit later this hour, USC professor Todd Boyd, the first academic to put together an academic discipline in hip-hop. And we'll be talking with the professor about his new book, Rapper's Deluxe, How Hip-Hop Made the World. USC professor Todd Boyd with us in just a few minutes. At yesterday's event at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Los Angeles, one of the categories our Film Week critics took up at the Oscar preview was Best Documentary Feature. 5 terrific films, and we heard our critics talk about all the different movies and what moved them so much about them. And I encourage you to listen to it. If you weren't able to attend yesterday, we'll be airing that full hour of our critics' look at the major Oscar categories this Friday on Film Week at 10 o'clock and Saturday at noon. But it's my pleasure to introduce the director of one of the five nominated films, Nisha Pahuja. Her film, To Kill a Tiger, is an absolutely gripping account of a family's ongoing battle with the criminal justice system and with those in the village where they live in India to get justice for their 13-year-old daughter, who was sexually assaulted by multiple perpetrators following a wedding in the village where they lived. Now, the daughter is now over the age of 18. She has given her consent to this story being told. Nisha, thank you so much for joining us and talking about it. First of all, I'm sure that listeners are concerned, well, what about, you know, the identity of this young woman now and her story coming out? Share with us what led up to her decision that she wanted this to be told.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you. So the film, she's now actually, she's 20. She just turned 20 recently. Because the film took so long to make, you know, and when we started filming, she was 13. And by the time we were done, you know, by the time we were finished, she was over 18. She was in a position to actually give us permission to show her face in the film. Initially, what we had decided is that we were not going to show her face in the film. We were going to find a way to kind of hide her while at the same time kind of retaining her presence and her humanity in the film. But because it took us so long to make, she could give us permission. And what she did is she asked to see the film. Her parents were very supportive of the idea of her mm-hmm. coming forward. But, you know, we all knew that it had to be fundamentally, it was her decision to make. So she asked to see the film. And my sound recordist in India flew to meet the family and showed the family the fine cut of the film. And they all just absolutely loved it. And she was so proud of herself. And that was fundamentally the decision, you know, to come forward had to do with her own pride at what she had managed to achieve at the age of 13.
And I think so much of the power of the film is seeing her facial expression, seeing the weight of this. And of course, the assault, which begins all these events, but the weight of the subsequent events and the villagers turning against the family for their decision to see this prosecuted, and all the hurdles in the Indian criminal justice system, you see the weight of that on her. And so I think it's very valuable to viewers that she made that decision. But it would have been understandable the other way, too, because she had gone through that years-long ordeal and that maybe she wouldn't want to put herself out there again.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there was no pressure, you know, on her. Like, we really wanted her to think about it and to, you know, to feel that she was doing the right thing, and taking into account also that, you know, this might be the way she feels now, but is she going to feel like this 10 years from now, you know? So there were lots of things that we discussed with her in terms of giving her, ensuring that she was making an informed choice.
And you don't use her real name.
We don't use her real name. We don't use her real name. We don't use the family's last name. We don't identify the village that they're from, you know. So there are measures in place to keep their anonymity as much as we can.
The father, Ranjit, is really, with the approval of his daughter, really is the major figure in pushing this through the criminal justice system. And we see his struggles, too, with alcohol and with tremendous guilt that he feels over leaving the wedding with his wife and the other kids and leaving the daughter behind, where she ends up at the end of the wedding when others have gone home being assaulted. And that's also a very powerful, because you see the toll that this takes on. Did he ever waver in his willingness to cooperate with the film?
With the film, no, never. His wife did. I mean, very early on, there was a moment where, again, you know, the community had come into their home. This was really, really early on in the filming. And the community had come in and had said, you know, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be speaking. And at the time, she was really nervous and she was anxious, so she asked us to stop filming. And at that point, it wasn't clear whether we were going to go, you know, whether we'd be welcome to continue. But Ranjit wanted us to come back. And it turns out, I mean, Ranjit is such an incredibly intelligent human being. You know, he's very, very sharp. And so we asked him why he wanted us, you know, why they wanted us to continue filming. And for him, it was very clear. It was essentially he understood that the film and the crew afforded him a certain kind of protection from the community. And it also ensured at court that he was going to be taken seriously. Because, you know, you have to remember, this is a farmer. He's poor. He's from a low caste, you know, considered low caste in India. He's an Adivasi, so he's a tribal, so even further marginalized. And so he understood what he was up against, and he also knew that there's a, you know, media is so powerful in India. And so the fact that we were documenting the story just meant that his case was going to be taken seriously.
And it did get tremendous publicity as well. The country really focused on this case.
Well, it wasn't the country so much, but the region.
The region of India?
That particular region.
Because you show a lot of the news stories as they're following what happens, particularly once it gets to court. We're talking with Nisha Pahuja, who is the director of the Oscar-nominated film To Kill a Tiger. It's one of the five Best Documentary Feature nominees at this year's Academy Awards. A very powerful film and a real family story. And I understand that the story that you ended up focusing on was not the story that you set out to tell with a film.
Exactly. And, you know, really, that is one of the key reasons that the film took so long to make. But in the end, you know, I think really it was the destiny of this film to take this long to make, because it meant that she could make the decision to come forward. And I don't think the film would be as powerful had she not made that choice.
You were looking to tell the story of a kind of men's movement to get men to behave in a way with women that was dignified and not abusing, which is a significant effort underway in India. That was what you were first highlighting,
correct,
as I understand.
Yeah, that was the initial film was a film that was looking at masculinity, and it was focusing on the work of an NGO that was running a gender sensitization program across 30 villages in the state of Jharkhand, which is where our story
takes
place. And
we see some of those meetings in your film.
Correct, absolutely. And Ranjit, who was the father in the film, was enrolled in this gender sensitization program, and that is how organically I came across him and the story and the story of what happened to his child.
You also show the huge economic setbacks. I mean, he's a subsistence farmer, and you just see how the weather with torrential rains can just destroy all the work he's put into crops. And he's trying to put all the labor, because he's rolling a boulder uphill with pursuing this legal case on top of, you know, trying to support his family in this incredibly low income village, and then with the hostility of the villagers as well. You mentioned about the scene where the villagers come into the home and tell the family, you know, what are you doing? You're disgracing the village. Why are, you know, your daughter should just marry one of the perpetrators of the rape and be done with it. And it's an incredibly powerful scene. What were your feelings toward the villagers as that was playing out?
Very complicated and surprising. You know, what was really surprising is, of course, you know, at that moment, because the crew is under threat, you know, the family's under threat and the crew is under threat. So, of course, there is an element of fear. You know, undoubtedly, that was something that I was experiencing. But more than the fear, the thing that I felt was remorse and a sense of shame for bringing on this, for being responsible in part for kind of a fraying of a very complicated social fabric. And, you know, because in India, these villages, I mean, we might have certain thought processes, and we perceive what they wanted as something obviously problematic, right? I mean, in terms of a human rights perspective, it's without a doubt problematic. That said, it is the culture, and it is the way they, it is what they think, and that comes from generations, right? And so that is, it's a deeply entrenched thought process and system, and villages in India are all about survival. That you know, the culture of India is a culture that is rooted not in the individual. It's a community-based culture, and it's a very important part of how people survive emotionally, financially, you know, spiritually. So I had gone in inadvertently, and I had sort of upset the apple cart, as it were. And yes, it was a necessary dismantling. I firmly believe that. But I also felt very sad and remorseful at the cost of it.
You said that so beautifully, because this is a very, and not that anyone is going to attempt to justify marrying off a 13-year-old to her attacker. But talking about these, you know, very, very old practices of keeping some degree of unity at tremendous cost to the individuals who pay the price for that. But this is, it's so fraught. And I'm sure for your crew, feeling the impact of your presence there and how that's affecting this, very difficult. But what happened afterwards? So what is the village like now? And do people feel any shame over the fact that they had proposed this, given what the outcome was in court?
I don't think that they think that their thought process was wrong. I think that they believe, and they always believed this, that the boys were wrong, that what had happened to her was wrong and it shouldn't have happened. Nobody condoned the actions of the boys. But I don't think that, you know, what was underlying their decision to sort of marry her off to one of the rapists, I don't think that thought process or that thinking has changed.
It's still there, you think?
I think so.
I was wondering, yeah, in light of, you know, the fact they took this all the way through the court system, punishment was meted out, that maybe there'd be some reflection about how much worse it would have been, how terrible it would have been to have pressured the girl into marriage.
Yeah, I don't think you can change centuries of deeply entrenched systems because of one landmark case, right? I think there's definitely a shift in thinking and probably a recognition that you have to take this seriously, otherwise there's punishment, there's fear, mm-hmm. But I don't know if fear is necessarily going to change the fundamental belief system. I think the only way to change fundamental belief systems is through very deep work with the community.
Is the family, and I don't know whether you can answer this or not, if not, is the family still in the village now?
Yeah, she isn't. She hasn't lived in the village for a long time, and she's now actually just wrote her police academy exam. She wants to be a police officer, but the father and the kids and mom, they're all in the community, and the community has actually, there's a lot of peace in the community, and there is a real kind of respect for Ranjit for doing, you know, what he said he was going to do and emerging victorious.
He and his daughter are remarkable figures, what they went through, and his wife also a central figure. You see how hard this is for her as she breaks at points along the way, understandably, under the tremendous pressure, yeah, that the family faces here. Such a powerful documentary. Nisha, thank you for coming in and talking with us about it. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. So appreciate it.
Yeah, very powerful story. The documentary To Kill a Tiger, it's Oscar nominated for Best Documentary Feature at this year's Oscars. Nisha Pahuja is the director of the film. Coming up on Air Talk, USC professor Todd Boyd, his new book, Rapper's Deluxe, How Hip-Hop Made the World. He's the chair for the study of race and popular culture and professor of cinema and media studies at SC. We'll talk with him in just a moment.
Oh. How to LA is our love letter to Los Angeles. We'll tell you where to get a yummy torta, a bowl of congee, and of course, a burger.
It's a beef sausage blend, fried egg, grilled onions, and then raspberry jam.
What hiking trails to check out.
This feels like we're out in the mountains.
And where to take in some culture.
Limerick Park, they've been fostering jazz for decades.
LA's a big place with a lot going on, so we got you. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle, Grandmaster Flash. The message never gets old. Let's hear a little bit.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Rapper's Deluxe, How Hip-Hop Made the World, the new book from USC professor Todd Boyd. He's chair of the study of race and culture and a professor of cinema and media studies at SC. Professor Boyd, welcome back to Air Talk.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Incredible pictures as well as your text in the book. And I just want to talk about, I mean, the influences of fashion, of 70s film, of soul music, so many different influencers that come into the rise of hip-hop. And to share with us a bit about the construction of the book and how those visuals are important to the music.
Well, the book covers sort of 50-year period from the early 1970s, 1973 to be specific, up until the present. And so broken down into five chapters, each chapter devoted to a decade. So we start with the 1970s. You know, hip-hop is underground in the 1970s for most of the decade until Rapper's Deluxe is released, Rapper's Delight, I'm sorry, is released in the late 1970s. But prior to that, you know, you have all these influences, blaxploitation movies, soul music.
Grew up in the 70s, so, and your dad, I know, is a huge film lover, took you to a lot of movies. So you're growing up just immersed in this.
Yes, I mean, you know, it was fascinating to look at magazines at a time when magazine photography was hugely influential and, you know, lobby cards in theaters when you would go to see a movie, looking at the you know, array of posters in the lobby might have been as interesting as the movie you were about to watch. You know, watching certain figures on television, athletes, all those things from the 70s, you know, eventually start popping up in hip hop in later decades. You know, references to blaxploitation movies, you know, Richard Pryor, the influential, hugely influential, iconic figure.
Even films that weren't like big box office, like The Mac, which is, you know, heavily influential.
Certainly, blaxploitation films like The Mac and Superfly and Dolomite. You know, so many of these things in the 70s, you know, are happening at the same time hip-hop is developing, and they later emerge in the culture in various ways. And so you sort of move through from the 70s to the 80s to the 90s, and you start to see how these influences, these seeds that were planted originally, start to manifest themselves later as the culture grows and expands.
Is there a particular event that's looked to as the birth of hip-hop?
Well, you know, hip-hop has this origin story, I like to call it. We seem to be obsessed with origin stories these days. DJ Kool Herc is, you know, figure who, you know, very well known in the Bronx. And as the story goes, and we open the book with this, his sister wanted to have a party before the first day of school to raise some money for herself so she could, you know, buy some new clothes, which I certainly understand. And Herc comes to be known for break beats. He notices when he DJs that the dancers get kind of most energized at the instrumental break that comes in right before the chorus. And to extend this, he decides to use two records instead of one, two turntables and a microphone. So this is a time when the DJ was still more prominent than the MC, who would become more prominent. But, you know, in my research, what I found out was the week of this party in August of 1973, the number one film at the box office during this time is Pam Grier's film Coffee. And I thought it was kind of an interesting parallel because in the 90s, of course, you would get the rapper Foxy Brown, which is based on another Pam Grier film, and also Quentin Tarantino's film Jackie Brown, again starring Pam Grier. So I just thought it was kind of interesting that the first sort of instance acknowledged of hip-hop, Herc's Party, is at the same time when the number one movie at the box office is a Pam Grier film, a blaxploitation film. And so it's kind of interesting how you can grow from there.
And Pam Grier, of course, continuing to act in so many different projects, being such a popular performer. And I don't know if you saw Quentin Tarantino's reopening of the Vista Theater in Los Feliz, Pam's Coffee. I saw that. Absolutely. So sort of the sense of what's cool, what's hip, even though that changes very rapidly in black culture because it doesn't stay static, it keeps moving forward, there's still throwbacks here in hip-hop to these earlier influences. So what's kind of the pivot point between breaking new ground but referencing back?
Well, hip-hop is a culture that's been, you know, from its beginning rooted in sampling as opposed to, say, jazz, where you have, you know, musicians creating, you know, music through their playing. Hip-hop is music composed of records and people sampling records and taking old sounds and recreating something new. And so there's always a sense of history, sense of nostalgia, a sense of reference in the musical tracks, in the sort of cultural references of the music. But it moves forward. And so from the 80s to the 90s, you know, you get into the 80s and hip hop expands, and into the 90s when it really multiplies, which is the longest chapter in the book because so many things happened. And then you go forward to the 2000s and sort of 2010 and beyond. But hip hop's always in conversation with its history. I think that's the very nature of it, because in a culture based on sampling, you're always revisiting the past and trying to find new meaning in something that already existed. And so there's a creativity inherent to it. And I think that conversation between past and present is something, you know, that's always prominent.
And I know that in the earlier years of sampling, this was difficult for many artists who felt they weren't properly credited or compensated. Now, of course, there's so many artists of the past who very proudly note how often their music has been sampled in later years. It's a point of longevity and their legacy continuing.
Well, there was a period of time when, amongst other things, there were a lot of court cases for a variety of reasons, one of which, you know, involved clearing samples that you couldn't, you know, just use somebody else's music and not, you know, credit it appropriately and compensate the individuals accordingly. And so, you know, I think with that in mind, hip hop has always honored and recognized the past, and it appreciates those connections. And so now, you know, people can look back and say, oh, I heard this sample, and maybe from the sample go back to the source. And in doing so, you learn about artists from previous eras, music from previous eras that maybe people weren't familiar with. So again, I think that's another example of being in conversation with its history.
Including jazz artists. I think of Roy Ayers and all the stuff has been sampled from Roy Ayers' ubiquity. We're talking with USC professor Todd Boyd. His new book, Rapper's Deluxe, How Hip-Hop Made the World, Decade by Decade, Look at the Evolution of Hip-Hop. And we welcome your calls, your questions for Professor Boyd. We're at 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com as we listen to Big Daddy Kane from 1989, Smooth Operator. And go to a slow tempo, and you know, sing ho, swing low, then yo, the show will go on. As I perform, transforming on stage. Speaking of sampling, you probably recognized Mary Jane Girls here, and All Night Long is the sample. Across the crowd, Rick James production. So let's groove with the Smooth Operator. Just so a little bit of Isaac Hayes sounded. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Back with more with Professor Todd Boyd in just 1 minute.
It's all good, baby, baby. Shake it, shake it. It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and pepper and Heavy D up in the limousine. Hanging pictures on my wall. Every Saturday, Rap Attack, Mr. Magic, Molly Mall. I let my tape rock till my tape pop. Smoking weed and bamboo, sipping on private stock. Way back when I had the red and black lumberjack with the hat to match. Remember rapping Duke? Da ha, you never thought that hip-hop would take it this far. Now I'm in the limelight cause I rhyme tight. Time to get paid, blow up like the World Trade. Born sinner, the opposite.
Notorious B.I.G. Juicy and... Yeah, I'm showing my age. I know the same. I'm 2 mes. see all the great samples that are included. We're talking about the history of hip-hop with Rapper's Deluxe author Todd Boyd. The book subtitled How Hip-Hop Made the World. Muhammad Ali. I accidentally turned my mic off with your book. Muhammad Ali, such an important figure in influence in hip-hop, and share with us how his ability with words and his bravado, him standing up for himself, factored into the music.
Well, you know, again, when we talk about the first chapter of the book, all these influences, Muhammad Ali is certainly a huge influence. Ali is someone who would rhyme, and he was doing this before hip-hop even existed. He had a rhyme for you before his fight, and it came to be part of his persona. But at the same time, you know, joining the Nation of Islam, refusing to participate in the Vietnam War, being exiled from his sport before ultimately returning in triumph, made him an icon and a hero. The second half of his career is unfolding as hip-hop is just beginning. And so if you listen to Rapper's Delight, one of the lines, you know, I got more clothes than Muhammad Ali and I dress so viciously. I mean, so, he's being acknowledged in the music for his iconic status from the very beginning. And, I think you can make a lot of connections between what Ali represented before hip hop and then the point at which, you know, hip hop emerged and someone like Ali would be a very prominent influence. The champ is here, you know, all these things he would say when he was arrived. Rappers, Big Daddy Kane, for instance, talks about like how much Ali influenced him. And so, you know, for people like myself who were part of that generation, Ali was huge and he touched everything. And I think maybe people haven't always thought about how connected he was to what would become hip hop in terms of his overall influence on the culture.
I want to talk also about the importance of strong speaking skills in the African-American community historically. I mean, going back to abolitionist voices in the church, pastors, and their prominence, how speaking skills are given a great spotlight in the Black community historically. How does that then factor into the wordsmith element and the speaking skills that we see in rap?
Well, I think, you know, it's all part of the oral tradition. You know, there was a time when the DJ was the most prominent figure in hip-hop, and as it became more popular, the MC, you know, the master of ceremony or the microphone controller, became the center, which is consistent with that oral tradition. You know, from griots to preachers to, you know, blues singers, you know, or just a cat on the corner, you know, sort of rhyming over the course of his day. You have to have good speaking skills, and there's a high standard, you know, and I think hip hop kind of extended that because you have so many wordsmiths. You know, the emergence of someone like Rakim adds a kind of poetic component to rapping and writing lyrics. And so, you know, there's a standard and it's competitive, and you can't just get on the mic and say anything. You have to do so with flair and style and skills. And so I think it all grows out of the same thing. That oral tradition is very important, and I think hip hop is perhaps a more recent representation of it, but it's rooted in some things that, you know, have a long history going back.
And Professor, the political impact of rap and hip hop, of course, huge, and so many groups, you know, we've heard locally Public Enemy, but so many others that have had such a high profile and been influential. What is your sense of the impact of those groups that have had political content at the center of their lyrics?
Well, hip-hop has been so many different things, and one of those things has been a place for people to articulate, you know, certain political ideas, to speak truth to power, to sort of challenge existing, you know, systems. You know, Chuck D and Public Enemy, certainly, but Ice Cube, you know, just so many artists over the course of time, even artists who aren't necessarily thought of as political rappers might say something political. And I talk about, you know, in the book, the election of Ronald Reagan, or, you know, Bill Clinton attacking Sister Soulja, or in the fourth chapter of the book, you know, on the flip side of that, hip hop helping to elect the nation's first black president. So, you know, when you talk about hip hop, it's part of culture, and it's not something existent in a vacuum. It's something that is connected to politics, to language, to sports, to fashion, to art. And so the political piece is very prominent, always has been, and I try to trace out in the book examples of this. Someone said to me, you know, all the books I've seen on hip-hop, I've never seen Angela Davis in a book on hip-hop. Well, Angela Davis is in the book. Great photo, these photos I curated for the book. You know, Angela Davis, you know, in her early 70s iconic status with the afro and the cigarette smoke. And I mean, it's cool, but, you know, it's connected to the Black Panther Party and the Nation of Islam, and a very kind of important transitional moment in the culture, which, you know, reflects itself in the music.
And then we have, of course, the Super Bowl halftime show at SoFi Stadium in Inglewood, in which hip-hop gets its day in front of the biggest audience in all of television. Is that the arrival?
Well, that's where I end the book, because, you know, I think about the early 90s when Michael Jackson performed at the Super Bowl, and now here we are so many years later, Dre and Snoop and Kendrick Lamar and those others are center stage.
As we hear Dre and Snoop on this track, next episode, from their 1999 album, Rappers Deluxe, How Hip-Hop Made the World. Todd Boyd, USC professor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Beautiful book, great history, decade by decade. Stay tuned. NPR's Here and Now is next.